VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable, and it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohamed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
Some children, not even young people, but children, some of them by age of 12 years old, was using their gun on air and sometimes on the M23.
The UN human rights chief has accused rebels who seized a second major city in eastern DR Congo of killing children. And reporter in Goma, Sabiti Jafar El-Khatanti, describes what may have led to that incident. Also, some analysts say the African Union summit merely strengthened the group's reputation for inability to resolve conflicts. And Sudanese paramilitaries have killed more than 200 people in a multi-day assault in the country's south. All this and more coming up on African News Tonight. The head of Uganda's People's Defense Forces recently said he will attack the town of Bunia in neighboring Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo unless all forces there surrender their arms. Meanwhile, the United Nations has decried what it calls summary executions of children by the rebel group M23 in Eastern DRC. Our reporter in Goma, Sabiti Jafar El-Khatanti, fills us in on the latest and begins by telling me that Uganda has sent additional UPDF troops to Eastern DRC over the past few days.
The Shujaa operation between FRDC and UPDF in the north of North Kivu and the south of Ituri province is ongoing since 2 years now. And the government of DRC and Uganda decided to create a second operation in Ituri where militia CODECO is killing Congolese people, especially those of the ethnic group of Hema. And now Uganda reinforced their troops in DRC because some will continue fighting against ADF in the north of North Kivu, the zone of Beni and Lubero, and others will go to the north in Ituri province to work alongside FRDC in fighting against CODECO and other militia in Ituri province. And when people saw the last tweets of the chief of staff of Uganda forces calling M23 leader hero, saying he's fighting, they are fighting for their freedom, people think that Ugandan chief of staff is an enemy of DRC as he's close to the M23 rebellion.
We have also heard and seen in the various reports that the UN is decrying what it calls summary executions of at least three children by the M23 in DR Congo's Bukavu city in eastern DRC this past week. Why would they execute children?
The reason why can be difficult to know, but, you know, the city of Bukavu was abandoned by the FRDC a night before that M23 came in Bukavu. And many soldiers were leaving their equipment in the city. So Bukavu had a lot of weapons anywhere, everywhere in the city. And some young guys, young people, took weapons and uniforms, starts working in Bukavu. Then when M23 get in the city, some children, not even young people, but children, some of them by age of 12 years old, was using their gun on air and sometimes on the M23. And when responding, M23 was killing these children. That's what sources in Bukavu said. And we also saw some videos of M23 shooting in the direction of these kids and telling people, let us know where are these kids which are playing with guns so that we must kill them.
And the UN spokesperson is also saying there's bona fide or documented cases of ill treatment, conflict-related sexual and gender-based violence. Have you been hearing about that too?
Yes, not only in Bukavu, that started in Goma, and this is general, you know, in eastern Congo, rape, has been used as a weapon of war since decades, and we must also know that the people who are implicated in this fighting are the same who were implicated in almost all fightings of Eastern DRC. They are the same actors with a different name. All Wazalendo were Mai Mai before, and all M23 officers and fighters were in the first M23, were in CNDP, were in RCD, and all these groups were pointed to be perpetrators of mass rape in the city they control. So in Bukavu, there were rape of many women, and we don't know if it's only M23 or only Wazalendo or only FARDC, but for now, Bukavu is under M23 control. M23 is the first to be pointed to be the actor of the mass rape of women in the city.
That's reporter Sabiti Jafar El-Khatanti. He was speaking to me from Goma in eastern DRC. Some regional analysts say the African Union summit in Addis Ababa merely served to strengthen the group's reputation for being unable to resolve any conflicts. Conflicts are raging across Africa, from Sudan to the Sahel, from Mozambique to Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, with the AU not playing a meaningful role in ending any of them. Darren Taylor reports.
Even as the African Union's outgoing and incoming leaders called for warring parties in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to respect a ceasefire, M23 rebels seized another key city in the region, and fighting continued to rage. DRC President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan leader Paul Kagame both attacked the AU, accusing it of lacking credibility. The AU wrapped up its annual summit on Sunday in Addis Ababa. An African affairs analyst at Fitz University in Johannesburg, Professor Bob Wekesa, says the AU lacks authority and some of its members don't respect it. He notes that the AU has never been good at ending conflict, one of its primary mandates.
We have to remember that this is the African Union that was taking over from the Organization of African Unity, which had been accused of merely being a barking dog that couldn't bite. And so from the optimism of the founders of the AU, including Thabo Mbeki, Olusegun Obasanjo, Abdoulaye Wade in 2000 to present, it has more failed than succeeded, in my opinion.
International relations expert Professor Gilbert Kadiagala says the AU and its Peace and Security Commission have very limited powers.
All the powers are with the member states. The commission is there to implement what member states are coming up with. So we have to be very modest about their roles on everything from financing to conflict resolution to peace building.
Kadiagala says it's difficult to stop conflicts on the continent because there's little unity among member states, not because the AU is badly structured. For instance, he points out, some member states condemn the role Rwanda is playing in Eastern DRC, while many others stay silent. The United Nations and the DRC government accuse Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels and of having sent Rwandan forces into Congolese territory. The Kigali government has never said it directly backs the rebels, but says it's defending its territory. Rwanda also accuses Kinshasa of backing a rebel group that aims to overthrow the Kigali government. Kadiagala says the AU sanctions some countries for conducting coups and not others.
I think we've pretty much lost the war on unconstitutional change of government. We've seen this happening in Mali, in Niger, in Burkina Faso. Those countries are still suspended from the African Union. And there is really no momentum for them to do what the AU told them to do, which is you need to return back to constitutional rule.
He says it's unfair to expect the AU alone to solve complex conflicts, such as those in DRC and Sudan.
The AU peacekeeping mechanisms are the last resort. First line of responsibility with nation states, because these countries are independent. So they have to put their houses in order. The second level of responsibility is sub-regional organizations like SADC, the East African Community. What's happening in the Congo? This is the level at which these countries have to show that they can in fact help countries that are in conflict resolve their problems.
Kadiyagala says the AU's new leaders would do well to instill a culture of proactive conflict prevention within the organization, so disputes are not left to simmer before they become wars. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Human rights activists, lawyers, and medical practitioners in East Africa are calling on the Ugandan government to release opposition leader Kizza Besigye, who has spent the past 3 months in military detention. Besigye, who was detained while on a trip to Kenya in November, was recently rushed to a hospital after going on a hunger strike to protest his imprisonment. Mohamed Youssef reports.
The Ugandan government is under fire for its trial of opposition leader Kizza Besigye and other political activists. Reading a statement on behalf of 12 organizations in Nairobi on Tuesday, the head of one of the groups, Khalid Hussein, said they condemned the militarization of justice and escalating government repression in Uganda.
We call on the Ugandan authorities to immediately release Kizza Besigye, Haj Obeid Lutale, Aaron Kizza, and others who are unlawfully detained. The abduction and rendition of Kizza Besigye and Haj Obeid Lutale blatantly violates international human rights law and the principles of extradition treaties.
A politician who ran against Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni in 3 elections, Besigye was abducted by unidentified men while on a visit to Kenya in November and taken to Luzira Maximum Security Prison in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. He appeared before a military court where former Kenyan Justice Minister and lawyer Martha Karua defended him. He is facing charges of treason, illegal possession of a firearm, and threatening national security. Last week, the 68-year-old fell ill and was rushed to the hospital after going on a hunger strike to protest his arrest and the charges. Ugandan lawyer Andrew Karamagi says the treatment of Besigye and other Museveni critics exposes ongoing rights violation in his country.
The medical union has spoken out and given a scientific medical analysis of Dr. Besigye's health, which is in serious jeopardy. Citizens who have attempted to protest this have as well been detained, and I should add, violently arrested, as some of you might have seen. This is a culmination of years of human rights abuses, disregard for the Constitution.
On January 31st, the Ugandan Supreme Court ruled that the trial of civilians in a military court is unconstitutional and that such cases must be transferred to ordinary courts. But the government rejected this move, saying such trials protect the country from criminals. In a statement posted on X, Museveni called on those demanding the release of Besigye to instead demand a quick trial to establish the facts. Otherwise, he said, such demands promote insecurity, which is dangerous for the country. Amnesty International East African Regional Researcher Ronald Ebole says a united voice against human rights violations can help end the abuses against people.
We are having cross-border repression. We are having a transnational repression where we are seeing abductions happening beyond borders. And these abductions are happening sanctioned or blessed by presidents, blessed by heads of state. And they are taking advantage of the fact that at the ground, we are not as united against them.
Rights groups say they will circulate petitions and will reach out to other states and non-state actors to demand the release of Ugandans unlawfully detained. The 12 organizations that took part in today's demonstration have called for people to join a march on Friday to the Ugandan High Commission in Nairobi and the Parliament building to present a petition for justice and the release of Besigye and those detained alongside him. Mohamed Youssef, VOA News, Nairobi.
Sudanese paramilitaries have killed more than 200 people, including women and children, in a 3-day assault on villages in the country's south. The Emergency Lawyers Group, which documents rights abuses, said the paramilitary rapid support forces attacked unarmed civilians in the villages of El Cadarus and El Kawat in White Nile State. The French news agency AFP reports the RSF carried out executions, kidnappings, and forced disappearances and property looting during last weekend's assault, which also left hundreds wounded or missing. The lawyer group said some residents were shot at while attempting to flee across the Nile River. Some drowned in the process, with the lawyers calling the attack an act of genocide. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington, and we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. European leaders held a crisis meeting in Paris to discuss Ukrainian and European security. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the meeting comes after a blizzard of diplomatic interventions by Washington that have raised doubts over the U.S. commitment to the transatlantic alliance, which many consider to be the bedrock of European security.
A few days of bruising diplomacy have shaken the foundation of European security. French President Emmanuel Macron hosted several European leaders in Paris for crisis talks Monday, including British Prime Minister Keir Starmer.
We Europeans will have to do more. The issue of burden sharing is not new, but it is now pressing. And Europeans will have to step up, both in terms of spending and the capabilities that we provide.
Starmer said he was prepared to commit British forces on the ground in Ukraine if there is a lasting peace agreement.
But there must be a US backstop, because a US security guarantee is the only way to effectively deter Russia from attacking Ukraine again.
A series of policy shifts by Washington has transformed Europe's geopolitical calculations. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told NATO allies last week that Europe must provide the overwhelming share of aid for Ukraine as it fights Russian invaders, adding that the United States was no longer, quote, primarily focused on the security of Europe. Then U.S. President Donald Trump spoke to Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, effectively ending Moscow's isolation. Both agreed to begin Ukraine peace talks in Saudi Arabia, scheduled for Tuesday, with Ukraine and Europe excluded from the table. Daniela Schwarzer is from the Bertelsmann Stiftung Foundation in Germany.
We are witnessing tectonic shifts of the order structures and also of the positioning of major powers.
European leaders must make some big decisions, another analyst says. Armida van Rij, head of the Europe program at Chatham House.
Not just maintaining, but upping support for Ukraine, given it's very clear that the U.S. is not going to play a major role anymore in the way that it has under Biden, but also for European defense and security in the medium to longer term, what that's going to look like. So there's huge questions hanging over Europeans.
Only 23 of 32 NATO members met the alliance target of spending at least 2% of gross domestic product on defense, let alone the 5% demanded by Donald Trump.
Well, that's going to be a really difficult thing for many Europeans who are operating in a fiscally very constrained space.
US criticism went beyond questions of defense. At the Munich Security Conference over the weekend, US Vice President J.D. Vance criticized mass migration and a perceived attack on freedom of speech in Europe.
The threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. And what I worry about is the threat from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values, values shared with the United States of America.
Those comments were described as unacceptable by German officials. Europe is reeling from the new tone in transatlantic relations, says Van Rij.
What has come at a surprise is the style in which this has been done. And that's been really kind of breaking all the norms in terms of how diplomacy is conducted, where really reality is hit very, very clearly.
A reality to which Europe and Ukraine must adapt fast. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Lawmakers in the U.S. state of Oklahoma are looking at a plan to start collecting information on the immigration status of students and parents in public schools. It's a proposed rule that some local school officials are already saying they will refuse to enforce. Scott Stearns narrates this story from Daria Vershalenko in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma schools would record parents and students' immigration status at enrollment under a proposal from State School Superintendent Ryan Walters.
Our rule around illegal immigration accounting is simply that. It is to account for how many students of illegal immigrants are in our schools.
Over the past 4 years, Walters says he estimates that Oklahoma spent more than $470 million educating children of undocumented migrants.
Those are resources. That is personnel that are having to be moved from inside the school year to meet the needs of those students. Those are numbers that we didn't have information on.
Oklahoma lawmakers are taking up the proposed rule, which would record but not prevent undocumented migrants from attending public schools. Samira Isaguirre came to the United States from Mexico more than 20 years ago. The legal immigrant and mother of six says the proposed rule could mean fewer undocumented children go to school.
Children should be out of politics.
In Tulsa, Union Public Schools administrators told parents they will not collect that immigration information. A statement from district spokesman Christopher Payne cited the Supreme Court's 1982 decision that all children have the right to public education, regardless of their immigration status. Protesting the proposed rule, Oklahoma teacher Fernando Baquera says it's already creating fear.
It's not right. It's not right for you to put fear in students and try to push them out of this free education that our Constitution says that everybody has, independent of who you are, where you come from.
But Walters wanting to count undocumented students makes sense to Todd Houston.
What Ryan Walters is actually proposing, which is very fair, and it helps the schools be able to know what they need to allocate.
Walter's proposal reflects some Oklahoma parents' concerns, says Tulsa school board member Elena Ashley.
He says sometimes the hard things that people are not willing to say. They want to know that their children are safe, and they want to know that they can be correctly educated in their classrooms and feel comfortable.
Walters says he would be required by law to share school immigration information with other authorities.
If a law enforcement official comes in and asks for information, we are legally required to give that information over.
Following the state school board vote to send the proposed immigration rule to the legislature, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt last week removed three board members, citing low national test scores and what he called needless political drama. For Daria Vershalenko in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Around 20 people were killed in northern Mali on Monday when the two vehicles came under attack. Local sources told the French news agency AFP that Wagner mercenaries and Mali's army were responsible. A relative of the driver of one vehicle told AFP from the northern city of Gao that the group was bound for Algeria when the deadly attack occurred. The relative said they had encountered a group of Wagner mercenaries and some Malian soldiers who shot at them. The source said everyone in the first car, including migrants and nomads, died. A military source told AFP earlier that the army did not attack anyone and no one was killed. Mali's army said in a statement late Monday that seven terrorists, as they called them, had been neutralized and weapons and ammunition recovered. And that wraps it up for us, this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Helen Cordian, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast comes to you at the top of each hour.